100 years ago, the Representation of the People Act was passed, which gave some women the right to vote in UK general elections for the very first time. The focus on early female suffrage campaigners in the UK tends to centre on the actions of the suffragettes in the capital. But the path to the voting rights we enjoy today has a much more complicated story. It was a national movement, fought by women and men of all classes, people of all ages and in locations right across the UK. People who lived and worked at places now in the care of the National Trust were also involved and influential throughout the campaign. This year, right across the Trust, properties are delving into their archives for the stories of people who took part in or bore witness to these momentous events. In this five-part series, you'll hear from house stewards, curators, volunteers and experts in a unique account of how Trust, people and places helped to bring about the freedoms that we enjoy today. For the full story, please do listen from episode one. Last time we heard how the roots of the women's suffrage movement emerged in Manchester and how these early suffrage groups used more refined forms of protest to campaign. In episode two, we'll hear how that was all about to change and how women from Trust properties found themselves at the centre of some of the suffrage campaign's most notorious events. I'm Kirsty Wark, and this is Women and Power, a podcast from the National Trust. It's the late 1800s, and after almost two decades of campaigning, female suffrage still has yet to be taken seriously in Parliament. The letter writing, marches and lobbying by Millicent Fawcett's suffragists have, it seems to some, left them no better off than when they started. Three particularly disheartened individuals are a suffragist campaigner called Emmeline Pankhurst and her two daughters, Sylvia and Christabel. Ellen de Vries, operations manager from the Pankhurst Centre, explains more.
All these words were being spoken by the suffragettes who were intelligent, they were lobbying, they had MPs speaking for them, but still nothing. And then there was a catalytic moment.
In 1898, Emmeline's husband, Dr. Richard Pankhurst, dies unexpectedly, and the Pankhurst world is turned upside down. As an instrumental member of the Independent Labour Party, a commemorative artwork is commissioned to honour his work and contribution.
There was a big hall being built in memory of Dr. Richard Pankhurst by the Independent Labour Party, and Sylvia was commissioned to do all the artwork. But then it became apparent to Emmeline and Sylvia and her sisters that they would never be allowed to enter that building.
This sense of tragedy and injustice, mixed with their disillusionment with the suffragist progress, leads Emmeline, her daughters and a small group of supporters to split from Millicent Fawcett's union and form a new group. They also campaign for women's suffrage, but this time things will be very different.
Their motto was deeds, not words. So doing, not speaking, because they'd had it.
Emmeline forms the Women's Social and Political Union in 1903. Their first act of militancy comes 2 years later. And over the next 9 years, militancy escalates steadily. In 1906, the press mockingly dubbed Pankhurst's Women's Social and Political Union the Suffragettes, implying that they're nothing more than a smaller and less significant version of the suffragists. But they claim the name as their own and become a movement that is anything but small and insignificant. In 1907, a women's suffrage bill is introduced into Parliament, but runs out of time. In 1909, suffragettes imprisoned for their militant actions begin to protest by going on hunger strike. In 1910, the first Reconciliation Bill, a precursor to the Representation of the People Act, fails in Parliament. The response is a protest that becomes known as Black Friday. Because of the extreme violence meted out by police, including allegations of sexual assault. In response, suffragettes move from mass rallies to the destruction of property, large-scale coordinated window smashing and arson. In 1911 and 1912, two more conciliation bills fail in Parliament. The suffragettes see this as a series of betrayals and further escalate the violence. Harassing politicians, chaining themselves to government buildings,
not touch me, sir!
And bombings. In 1913, while protesting at the Epsom Derby, Emily Davison is struck by the King's horse.
Emily, where are you going?
4 days later, she is dead. Although many trust properties and places give off the air of a genteel period drama, if you look hard enough, you can find links to this violent radical movement in some very unlikely places.
My name is Joe Daggett. I'm a countryside manager for the National Trust, covering Brecon Beacons in Monmouthshire. Part of my sites includes the Sugarloaf Mountain near Abergavenny in South East Wales. The Sugarloaf is an amazing place, really. Lots of wild heathland and woodland. It's quite amazing, really, that this place, this wild mountain landscape, has a link to the suffragette movement.
Sugarloaf Mountain, a landscape gifted to the National Trust, was owned by Welsh industrialist David and Sybil Thomas, the first Viscount and Viscountess Rhondda. Sybil Thomas becomes an active member of the moderate suffragist movement and a passionate feminist. Sybil hoped that her daughter might also become a feminist too. And that's exactly what her daughter, Margaret Lady Rhondda, becomes, although not quite in the way her mother envisages. Jane Bryant, Welsh Assembly member for Newport West, continues.
I think Lady Rhondda's mother would have wanted her being a feminist, but I'm not sure she would have wanted her to be a suffragette. But that's what Lady Rhondda became, and she really followed that deeds not words call, one of the many women who did. Locally, she was incredibly important. She was the secretary of the suffragettes here in Newport. We do hear that it's mainly in London, but it really wasn't. It really got into every community, I think. To be a suffragette, it could cause huge amount of pain, huge amount of problems for your family, whether that's in your job. So some of those things were much quieter, but others would have been quite brave about what they were doing.
One action that Lady Rhondda may have seen as brave is her involvement in one of the suffragettes' most controversial and dangerous forms of protest.
She felt that she had to do something to sort of do this deeds not words, and there was a campaign, a postbox campaign around Britain at that time, and she'd gone to London to get some homemade explosives, travelled back on the train, believe it or not. She blew up this postbox here, which is in front of us, but she did destroy some of the letters that were in it, but it is here still standing today for everybody to see.
For this, Lady Rhondda is sentenced to 4 months in prison, where she, like hundreds of suffragettes around the country, uses hunger striking as a form of protest.
When she was in prison, I mean, it would have been like many women who would have gone to prison at the time. She wanted to stay in there as long as possible to go on hunger strike. That was the intention. And obviously with that, the government had had the policy of force feeding, which would have absolutely been horrific for anybody to go through that.
Another militant suffragette with links to the National Trust is Violet Ann Bland, a former kitchen maid at Dudmaston Hall in Shropshire.
I'm Alex Blakeman. I work at Dudmaston in Shropshire, a 3,000-acre estate of woodland, parkland and a 17th-century family home. Dudmaston was home to Violet Ann Bland, who worked here as a kitchen maid. Let me take you to where she worked. We are just walking into what was the old kitchen. It might sound a little bit echoey because it's now an art gallery. It was turned into an art gallery in the 1970s by the last owners before it was given over to the National Trust.
This kitchen is where Violet spent most of her time as a maid for the Dudmaston estate, working with some 10 fellow servants. She spends around 12 years working here before moving on to Cirencester. By the turn of the century, she is the head of domestic science at a ladies' college in Bristol. And by the early 1900s, she's become a hotelier.
She was obviously a very ambitious person. She came from being a kitchen maid and 10 years later was owning her own hotel. So that says to us that she had quite strong personal ambition, but we don't quite know how that jump was made. Violet was a militant activist, a political member of the Women's Social and Political Union, and while she owned the hotel in Bristol, she advertised for paying guests, many of whom were active members of the suffragettes movement.
Violet is committed to militant action and in 1910 is arrested during a rally in Bristol. She's involved in the violence on Black Friday and later imprisoned, where she goes on hunger strike. Violet is one of the many suffragettes who becomes a victim of force-feeding, the government tactic to deal with this form of protest. Here's Sophie Duncan, Junior Dean of Arts at the University of Oxford.
You have a lot of women who have been going on hunger strike in prison. That is a form of non-violent protest, but increasingly they are force-fed. And force-feeding is an extremely brutal experience. Women are fed through the mouth, through the nose, and there is some evidence that some women were also fed through the rectum. They're really violent, debilitating experiences which some women liken fairly predictably and understandably to rape.
Suffragette accounts refer to being locked in cells and hearing the misfortune of fellow inmates as their screams echo through the corridors, becoming louder and louder and closer and closer. Choking, gasping, moans, cries of distress. They can hear with mounting horror the ordeal happening in the adjacent cells. Here's Vicky Iglikowski, record specialist at the National Archives.
Essentially, the people that you would have been hearing being force-fed would have probably been your friends and your allies. To go through that, I think, was a really horrific experience.
This would have gone on for hours until it was your turn.
The mixtures of things they got force-fed, things like milk, brandy, beef extract, Horlicks is one of the things, really horrible mixes of things that could kind of go down these tubes. You can understand that they really did resist it. Hold her legs down, hold it. Women would often be held down by wardresses, multiple people surrounding them. I think the instinct of many suffrage supporters was to resist being force-fed, and that was another way they often got injuries, was through that resisting. They'd get bruises from the struggle with the wardresses. Not everyone went to prison for the cause, but even if they didn't, they would often support in other ways. They would gather outside prison cells and sing suffrage songs. It was really a way of raising morale while people were in prison. Even within prison, they did other protests as well, so it wasn't just hunger striking. They would often break prison windows if they felt the treatment was unfair. So they really kind of continued the struggle and the fight within the prison grounds as well.
As a working class woman, Violet Anne Bland was treated more brutally than some. When she is released, an account of her treatment is published in Votes for Women, the Suffragettes magazine.
They pinched and clutched my nose unmercifully, and at the end of the assault, when I did not rise quickly from the chair because of my helpless and breathless condition, they snatched the chair from under me and flung me on the floor. There is no doubt whatsoever about the attacks being made with the object of breaking us down. During the strike, the wardresses were transformed into inhuman brutes and fiends, and one could not but feel that, like the police on Black Friday, they were being made use of by the government for this dastardly purpose. It is said some of the wardresses are nurses. I say, it is a parody on nursing, and the places where such nurses are produced should be instantly closed. On Wednesday, June 26, they twisted my neck, jerked my head back, closing my throat, held all the time as in a vice. I gasped for breath and suffered tortures mentally lest the food which they were trying to pour down my throat should go into my lungs. They do not expect or intend one to swallow the food, but pour it into one's stomach as through an open water pipe. There was really no possibility of the victim doing much in the way of protesting, excepting verbally, to express one's horror of it.
Even though it is a mentally and physically damaging method of protest, the hunger strikes are extremely effective. As more suffragettes adopt the tactic, the government feels it can only be a matter of time before a life is lost. Their solution is the Cat and Mouse Act.
When women start to be really damaged and debilitated by force feeding, they are released. And obviously, once they're out of prison, the women's health improves. But as soon as their health improves enough to be safely returned to prison, they're brought back to serve the rest of their sentence.
The suffragettes' extreme methods of protest split public opinion. Some agree with the cause and the means, while others sympathise with the message but disapprove of the tactics. These polarising views cause friction within communities and amongst friends. Views on female suffrage could even vary wildly within the same family. One such family are the Acklands of Killerton.
My name's Eileen Dillon, and I'm the learning officer at Killerton House in the southwest, which was the home of the Ackland family. Killerton is unusual in that the entire estate was handed over to the National Trust, which means that it also includes 250 cottages, 20 working farms and 6,000 acres of woodlands.
Two members of the Ackland family are Eleanor Ackland and her aunt Gertrude.
They were both totally opposed to the militancy of the suffragettes. Eleanor's position was really quite interesting. She felt very strongly, and she wrote about this in letters to Christabel Pankhurst. Well, Eleanor and Gertrude appeared to have quite a good relationship. They shared the same home, came from the same family, and moved in the same social circles. They were both outraged by the bomb that was placed in Lloyd George's house, given that Lloyd George was known to them and visited Killerton. Where they were completely divided was on their views on women's suffrage. Eleanor was the vice president of the National Union of Women's Suffrage Societies in its southwest branch, whilst Gertrude Ackland was the founder member of Exeter's Anti-Suffrage League, so their views on women's suffrage couldn't have been more opposed.
For many women and men at this time, it isn't whether you agree with the methods of the suffragists or suffragettes. It's whether you agree with the notion of female suffrage at all. In 1908, regional groups started to appear campaigning to oppose female suffrage. In the Ackland household lived two couples with opposing views. Eleanor and her husband Francis are pro-suffrage, and Gertrude and her husband Charles are staunchly anti-suffrage.
It appears to me that Gertrude and Charles were really at odds with most of their family. They were all liberals. I wonder whether other family members were rolling their eyeballs when Charles and Gertrude came into the room.
It's easy to imagine how politically charged and heated the conversations between the two couples would have been.
We found a quote that one of the relatives reported a conversation that she had with Cuthbert. Cuthbert is Eleanor's son. He reportedly said, "Do we really have to discuss politics at every meal?" So it's very clear that politics was a subject of conversation at the table. We are not saying that those people sat together all at the same time. Based on quotes we have found, if they did all sit at the same table, we imagine their conversation would have sounded something like this.
Yes, his whole speech about suffrage was marvellous. Women can do without suffrage, which I believe would be injurious.
That is nonsense, Charles. We must open up the political career to all who can give good service to the state. I mean, it just makes sense.
Removal of the sex disability as desired by the various suffrage societies means a preponderance of 1 million women electors over men. Such a revolutionary change must be fraught with danger to the stability of the empire.
Rot.
Gertrude, don't you understand that many people are growing more and more discontented at the way in which women's claim to self-government is continually ignored?
This family, does politics have to dominate every meal?
Really, Cuthbert, you're incorrigible.
Throughout the early 1900s, the issue of female suffrage continues to polarise popular and political opinion. Suffrage violence continues to intensify, and anti-suffrage sentiment also gathers pace and power. Next time on Women and Power. Anti-suffrage groups join forces to block the female vote being passed through the House of Lords. But amongst many National Trust figures on both sides of the debate, there's one person whose power and influence is key to the success or failure of female suffrage, making it into UK law. Women and Power is more than just this podcast. To celebrate the centenary of the Representation of the People Act, the National Trust is running a year-long programme of talks, exhibitions and installations, as well as publishing guidebooks and online articles. To learn more about the National Trust's Women and Power public programme, go to nationaltrust.org.uk/womenandpower. And to learn more about the Trust locations featured in this episode, type Sugarloaf Mountain, Dudmaston or Killerton into the search bar of our website, nationaltrust.org.uk. Make sure you don't miss next week's episode by subscribing on Apple Podcasts or wherever you find great audio. While you're there, you might also enjoy episodes of the National Trust flagship audio programme, the National Trust Podcast. To find out more about audio programming from the National Trust, go to nationaltrust.org.uk/podcasts.